G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Don't forget to sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
Good morning, good day, good evening.
How are you, my friend?
How are you, Jono?
I'm doing really well, because actually I'm quite excited, because speaking of Facebook, you've created a Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page. Will you let everyone know?
Let everyone know that you just did.
Yeah, I did, didn't I?
You did. Yeah, so what I've tried to do is set up this page so that people who listen to the show or people on Facebook that want to interact with me that have questions that they might want to ask, it's really a better way of contacting me. I know people will often comment on truth2u.org. On the when you put up the teachings, but you know, sometimes I don't get to them. I'm sure you check them, but people might be posting a question, and it would be really better if they go to Treasures from the Tanakh on the Facebook page there, and that way they can ask questions, they can see teachings, they can see teachings for other people from other people on Truth to You, and then some of the other teachings that I do outside of Truth to You as well.
Excellent, excellent. And so just let everyone know, Treasures from the Tanakh, if you put that in the search of Facebook, the page will come up, like it, and interact with the information there. Now, before we leave that topic, just let everyone know there's a couple of photos there. The first one seems like some ancient ruins. What is that? Let everybody know the details of those.
Right, so the picture, the background picture that you see when you go to Treasures from the Tanakh is actually a picture of the ruins of the synagogue at the top of Masada.
Cool.
And as people know, Masada was the last holdout of the some of the zealots that stood against the Romans. And you can actually still see the Roman encampments from on the top of Masada. But what's really amazing is that if you look at the thumbnail on there, that the picture that's kind of in the foreground, the smaller picture, you'll actually see the picture of a little room. And in that room, you'll see a Torah scroll rolled out that's actually being written. And why is that significant? Because that Torah scroll is actually being written in the little room around the corner of the first picture. So there's literally a scribe called a sofer in Hebrew that to this day is writing a Torah scroll in the most ancient synagogue in the land of Israel on Masada.
That is exceptionally cool. So they're the photos. So once again, I encourage the listeners to go there, like the page, check out the photos and engage in the information, leave some comments, and get involved there. Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page. Grand. My friend, we are up to chapter 12 of Job. How about that?
We are.
Job gets to have his say a little, and it goes on for a few chapters. And if we get time, we may even make it to the end of chapter 14. We'll see how we go. But it begins like this. You ready?
Well, so before we even start reading, there's a couple of interesting facts that I just wanted to bring out before we actually start reading, because it's interesting that each of his friends spoke, and that each of their speeches became shorter and shorter while Job's became longer and longer. It was looking at it like Eliphaz, his speech was 48 verses. Mm-hmm. And then Bildad spoke for 22 verses. And then Sofar was just a little more than 20 verses. And then we look at Job, and his first response was 25 verses. His second was 51 verses. His third was 57. And now if we do these three chapters, it'll be 75 verses.
Wow.
That he brings an answer. So you think he's just a little bit frustrated with these guys?
I reckon he is, and we kind of touched on the fact that particularly so far speaks to him as if he's a child, and as if he's, you know, intellectually inferior, but you know, that so far is, you know, so much wiser than Job. And that's kind of where we left off. And it begins with Job answering him and saying, look, no doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you, but I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Indeed, who does not know such things as these? And so he's replying to Sofar, and he's saying, come on, dude, don't talk to me like I'm a child. What do you think? I don't know some of the most basic things that you've just... You've spoken to me as if it's the first time I've heard it. Don't patronize me.
Sure, it's kind of funny because you almost have to decide whether or not Job is saying, is legitimately saying that they are more wise than he is, or whether he's actually making fun of them.
I think he's being sarcastic.
Well, I would tend to agree with you, but of course there's always, different people have differing opinions. Mm. And so some people actually come with the argument that he's saying, okay, you guys are wiser than I, but that doesn't make me a fool. Mm. I think he's making fun of them.
Yeah, I think he is. I guess both can be, yeah, I can see your point, but I like to think anyhow that he's going, oh, you're so smart, aren't you? You're so wise. You guys really are it. But hey, come on, I'm really not an idiot.
Well, and of course we know that from the next verse, which you read, because really the Hebrew, if you wanted to read it literally, it would be also to me as a heart. It says gamli levav. Mm-hmm. And usually heart and mind are interchangeable because the heart is the seat of the emotions. So he's saying also to me as a heart or a mind like you, and I'm not inferior to you. Okay, big deal. You're telling me something I don't know. Who doesn't know such things? So he is making fun of them.
And he does go on to say that. So verse 4, I am one mocked by his friends who called on God and he answered him, the just and the blameless who is ridiculed. A lamp, Ira, a lamp is despised in the thought of one who is at ease. It is made ready for those whose feet slip. A lamp. What do you have in the Hebrew?
So in the Hebrew, it says in verse 4, we read, Shechok lelrehu eye kore leloha v'yanehu shechok tzadik tamim. And it basically, what you read, I have become a laughingstock to my friends. Mm-hmm. Call to God and he has answered a righteous, blameless laughingstock is what he's basically saying. Mm. Okay? I'm a righteous, blameless. And then lapid buz la'ashtut sha'anan, I'm sorry, nachon lemo'adei ragal. Actually, what I have in the Hebrew is the thought of the self-confident shows contempt for disaster. It is prepared mm-hmm. for the staggering of foot.
Isn't that interesting? Disaster. You've got disaster. I've got lamp. Where do they get lamp from?
Well, I'm going to look at the... that's a good question.
I don't understand. It's interesting because if I mean, in mine it says a lamp is despised in the thought of one who is at ease. But why not say a disaster? Disaster is despised in the thought of one who is at ease. It is made ready for those.
Right. I'm trying to even figure what word they're looking at as being a lamp in verse 5.
I think it's the one that you have translated as disaster.
Yeah, I understand that, but I'm trying to.
It's bewildering. Okay.
it is bewildering. I mean, I don't know where they get that from. I'm not sure myself.
Yeah. Maybe the listeners have a comment on that. Verse 6, the tents of robbers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure in what God provides by his hand.
Mm.
So, I mean, is this a way of Job saying, look, you know, I mean, check it out. Have a look around. Not everyone who does evil lives a terrible life and is covered in sores and has their house crumbling around them and their children die and so on and so forth. Not everyone who does bad things actually, it doesn't work out that way all the time. Is that the case he's making in verse 6?
Sure, and this is one of the arguments that we see him making pretty much throughout his responses, where he's basically saying that why should I, look, it doesn't matter. God brings this kind of judgment upon you, whether you're righteous or wicked.
Mm-hmm.
The robbers are at ease in their tents, he says, and secure who angered or provoked God,
mm-hmm.
to which he is brought into God's hand. So basically, if you kind of look at all these first six verses that we look at, basically he's responding to so far, and he's saying, okay, so far you've called me empty-headed, and yet I'm a righteous, blameless man that has wisdom just like you do.
Mm-hmm.
And while you may feel safe and secure, be careful, my friend, because you who think you're comfortable in your tents can easily stumble. Mm. You could easily lose your footing, and then it's possible that you also will fall.
Mm-hmm.
And who will be laughing then when he has brought you into my hands?
Mm.
and this is you know, this is interesting because you look at Tehillim, like Psalm 123. Starting in verse 1, it says, "To you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. Behold, as the eyes of the servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid to the hands of her mistress, so our eyes to Jehovah our God until he is gracious to us. Be gracious to us, O Lord, be gracious to us, for we are greatly filled with contempt. Our soul is greatly filled with scoffing of those who are at ease, and with the contempt of the proud." You know, this is, of course, you know, David HaMelech, King David, is speaking about this, but it's similar to what Job is saying here so far.
Sure. And so further to what we were saying earlier in the chapter, he goes on in verse 7, "But now ask the beasts, and they will teach you. Ask the birds of the air, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you. And the fish of the sea will explain it to you. Who among these, all these, does not know that the hand of Jehovah has done this?" So he's pressing the point, is he? He's really saying, look, what you've been trying to tell me, so much of that is just common knowledge. I mean, everybody knows it. Even the animals know it, and the earth know it. You ask them, and they'll tell you.
Right. And so when you look at the next verse, where he says, "Asher biado nefesh kol chai v'ruach kol basar ish," in his hand is every living soul and the breath of the flesh of all man. He's really, I mean, look, he's saying, you're calling me an empty-headed fool, and yet the fish and the animals, they know. You're acting like the wise guy here.
Yeah.
He's basically, so what he's doing in a sense is he's answering so far with the same type of disdain.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically saying, you think you're so wise, and yet the beasts, the birds, the fish have as much wisdom as you do.
That reminds me of a verse.
Yeah.
Now, this is in Proverbs, and I think it's Proverbs chapter 14 that says, "Answer a fool according to his folly." It's a really odd verse.
Proverbs 26:4.
Okay. "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes," which is 26:4-5. And mm-hmm. And verse 5, I think here, do you think it's fair to say that here is an example of verse 5? Job is answering Zophar according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Here's Zophar, who's elevated himself as the one who knows, because he's quite confident that Job is at fault and that Job doesn't know. He feels like he's got the support of his other two friends, and that he can go hard on Job and as I say, elevate his own wisdom above Job. But Job answers him. He answers the fool. He answers so far according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. And so he's cutting him back down, really. He's saying, listen, the beasts, they know, the animals know, the birds know, the fish know, the earth knows, everybody knows. Who among these do not know that the hand of Jehovah has done this, in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? He's knocking him back down. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's very fair. And that's really two good verses to bring to show what's happening here. But it's also interesting to note that Job presents opposing arguments on his own position as well. And we're going to see that throughout, that, he makes an argument like he does that God is not really concerned with man. He's kind of made that from the beginning as well, that somehow God is not concerned. We talked about that the God is in the lofty heights, mm-hmm. and really is not concerned with man. And then the other hand, he's going to begin to speak now about the divine providence of God.
Mm-hmm.
So we even see him bringing different opinions. But then again, look, you know, he's the one that's really suffering. I mean, we kind of have to give him a little leeway to go back and forth, because we have no idea what kind of suffering and pain he's in when he's bringing these arguments.
True. "Does not the ear test words and the mouth taste its food? Wisdom is with aged men, and the length of days, understanding. With him are wisdom and strength. He has counsel and understanding. If he breaks a thing down, it cannot be rebuilt. If he imprisons a man, there can be no release. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the earth. With him are strength and prudence. Now, Ira, I mean, we're going to have to go back, but let's comment on this when we get to it. In verse 16, the deceiver, the deceived and the deceiver are his.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Amen. Amen. So going back and looking at those verses, you know, is wisdom in the aged and understanding in the length of days. So saying, and then with him are wisdom and power, to him counsel and understanding. So Job is saying, look, you've lived long enough to understand that only with God are wisdom, power, counsel, and understanding. And I've lived long enough to understand that the wicked are at our ease in their tents, because I've lived long enough to see mm-hmm. it myself. Mm-hmm. In verse 13, he's basically, you know, beginning this this argument again of what chance does a man have to protect himself from the mm-hmm. divine decree. In other words, God can do whatever he chooses. And this is one of those times that we see Job, and we can only assume, again, that it is not only his frustration with his friends, but with God as well, that he begins to bring this opposing opinion to something that he said previously. Early, he complained about how there is an order to the animal world,
mm-hmm.
but chaos in the affairs of man. Now he maintains that all is in the hands of God. And so I think this begs the question, and then he begs the question and then answers it in the ensuing verses. Why would the master of order and harmony wish to wreak such havoc in the lives of men?
Mm.
And then we see this, you know, we see all these verses where he talks about the providence of God, where God tears down and God builds up, and he imprisons man. And if he imprisons a man, there can be no release. And he restrains the waters and they dry up, and he sends them out and they inundate the earth.
If he does it, who can reverse it?
Sure. With him are strength and sound wisdom. I have the misled and the misleader belong to him.
I guess that's similar. The deceived and the deceiver, the misled and the misleader. Same. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. It actually says lo shegeg umashge. So it's speaking about erring, to err,
mm-hmm.
and the one who is caused and the one who causes to err. You know, sure. So it's basically saying the same thing, misled and a misleader, the deceived and the deceiver, the one who errs, the one who sins, and the one who causes to sin, so forth. All of this belong to him. And this goes hand in hand with what we've been saying.
That's right.
All along, that good and evil both come from God.
Mm, that's right. And we did comment, of course, on that passage in Kings where a deceiving spirit. A spirit says, I will go and become a deceiving spirit, a lying spirit, in the ears of the prophets of Ahab, and I'll cause him to go out to battle and cause him to lose his life. And Yehovah says, good one, off you go, and you'll succeed.
Yeah, so I was going to say, if we have to throw it in there again, basically what we're saying, folks that are listening, is there's no capital S, horns and tail and pitchfork guy with the name Satan,
mm-hmm.
No matter how much you love the character on Saturday Night Live, the church lady, and Flip Wilson, who used to say the devil made him do it. Mm. The truth of the matter is that both good and evil are in the hands of Yehovah, and it is Yehovah that either allows somebody to speak for the good or to somebody speak for the evil, as you made mention in that verse in Melachim, in Kings.
So there is no capital S, but there is, of course, Hasatan, which is the adversary. But, of course, as we read at the beginning of Job, the adversary is Yehovah's, they're his. And this is the point that it makes. And so,
Hasatan is basically a Malach Elohim.
Of course.
He's a messenger of the Most High. He's a messenger of God.
As we see in Numbers as well. So people, if you're listening to this one and you're freaking out and you don't know where to go with that, and you haven't listened to the programs at the beginning of Job, you need to go back and do that to to just catch up with where we are there.
But sure, go to the teaching that you did with Yoel.
Yes, Hell, Hades, and Hasatan. Well. We did a program on that as well.
It's also a great teaching on that subject.
Indeed. He leads counselors away plundered and makes fools of the kings. He loosens the bonds of the kings. He binds their wrists with a belt. He leads, now, Ira, he leads, yeah. This is what I've got. He leads princes away plundered and overthrows the mighty. He leads princes?
In verse 19?
Mm.
No.
What do
no,
you got?
Of course not.
What do you mean?
I have, that's what it says. Okay, well, it probably says that in your what? Your new That's King Jimmy?
In my new King Jimmy in the English.
Well, what do you expect? I mean, this is a guy that put his name into the Bible. So.
come on, what does
we're
it say?
Gonna, we're going to trust him.
Are you telling it me says, it says something different?
It does.
It says
Molich Kohanim Sholal.
Kohanim?
Kohanim.
What are we to understand that he leads Levites away, plundered? What? But I mean, Job was actually written around the time of Abraham. Actually,
it says Molich Kohanim Shalal. He makes the priest to walk barefoot.
Wow.
The etanim yisalef, and the strong he overturns.
How do we understand that? What Kohanim is Job talking about? I mean, if we say. And most opinions would agree, I think. There are some other opinions as well that can't be necessarily ruled out. But, you know, let's say that of course, Job is he's a real person, and he was a contemporary of Abraham, and this is way before Moses and Aaron. And so how do we understand this? What Kohanim is being spoken of here?
Well, I mean, look, you know, if we see him as a contemporary of Avraham, you know, depending on the dating, we know that it's certainly before temple times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
we also know, of course, that Job had an altar and he was offering sacrifices on behalf of his children. So that was obviously not a foreign concept.
Yeah, we do know that. And so it wasn't a foreign concept. So I'm not sure that we can really make the determination. But I think what's really mm-hmm. interesting is that word barefoot there, you know, this idea of sholal. It actually, you know, I'm looking at it to see in one of my dictionaries if I can see that there's another, and there really is, there's another interpretation, which means to be stripped off. And so that could speak to the idea of not barefoot, but the fact that he strips the priest of his clothing, kind of like takes away the priesthood from him. To be defrocked, basically, yes. Although that kind of puts pictures of Friar Tuck in my mind.
Yeah.
That's not just, I may have to scrub my brain after the show.
Sorry to do that to everyone. But the concept is there. So that is really interesting. And so it does kind of perhaps suggest that there is a place of service to God, and that there are recognized ones who serve, recognized Kohanim, and that Yehovah, in the same way that he leads counselors away plundered. Now, by the way, that's the same word I've got in the English, at least in 17. He leads counselors away plundered. And then in 19, he leads, well, I've got princes away plundered, but he leaves Kohanim away plundered. Is it the same wording in 17?
I'm actually looking at that to see that, and the answer is no, it is not the same word. It actually is yo'atzim, and yo'atzim, in my translation, says counselor as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then 19, of course, says Kohanim. So there is a difference between the two.
Of course, but what happens to the counselor in 17?
The same thing. Molich Yoatzim Sholal.
So again, he is stripped. The counselor is stripped of his...
The counselor is stripped or caused to walk barefoot. But it's the same. It's the idea of stripping him of his authority is basically what I would say.
There it is. Okay, so it goes on to say...
And wait, you know, so those three verses taken together, I mean, look, he's talking about counselors. He loosens the you know, it talks kings, about counselors, judges, kings, and priests.
Yeah.
So it's dealing with everybody who has authority.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. He deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of elders. He pours contempt on princes. Now, here we do have the word princes, right? This is verse 21. I've got, he pours contempt on princes and disarms the mighty.
Well, it actually can be a nobles.
Okay.
Is what it would say. Typically, when you see prince, you see the word nasi. This actually is nidivim, and it could be nobles. Actually, mm-hmm. another translation could be it could relate to the nobleman, but it could be somebody who's generous as well. But I think in the context here, it's talking about the nobleman.
Sure. And certainly, I mean, the application of princes is probably more a little closer than it is with Kohanim. But anyway, right. He pours contempt on princes. He disarms the mighty. He uncovers deep things out of the darkness and brings the shadow of death to light. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and guides them. He takes away the understanding I've got. He takes away the understanding of the chiefs of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a pathless wilderness. They grope in the dark without lights, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man.
Mm-hmm. So actually the Hebrew in verse 24 says, Mesir lev rashi am haaretz. So basically it says he turns away the hearts of the heads of the people of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at an English translation here that says he deprives of intelligence the chiefs of the earth's people and makes them wander in a pathless waste.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you recognize that these verses that you just read all kind of have a negative connotation, you realize that that once again we kind of see Job remaining persistent in his questioning the justice of God,
sure.
Which to him his friends just passively accept.
It also can be, I suppose, the way I read it, I read it as a reinforcement of the or an acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God, as if to say, look, he can do what he wants. He does these things. Who am I that I can even contend with him in this regard, because this is how great he is, and this is the sovereign decisions that he makes.
But however he does, and that's the interesting thing, because he will make the argument in the next chapter as we move into 13 that basically what happens is that his friends are just kind of passively accept this idea, and he kind of begins to argue that a little bit, that you can't just passively accept this.
Amen.
That this is the justice of God.
Chapter 13, behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. Am I inferior to you? So again, he's just reiterating, listen, don't talk to me like I'm an idiot. Don't talk to me as if you think you're smarter than me. The things that you're saying, I know what you're saying. Don't, come on. But I would speak to the Almighty and desire to reason with God. But you, forgers of lies, you are all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be silent and it would be your wisdom. Now hear my reasoning and heed the pleadings of my lips.
Wow.
Mm.
So in verse 3, look, he already, in verse 2, he's almost saying word for word, similar wording to what he said in chapter 12, verse 3, in 13, verse 2, where he talks about not being inferior to them. But then in this verse 3, when he says, Ulam ani el Shaddai adaber v'chokeach, where you would say, however, I would speak to the Almighty, and I would desire to, this idea of hokeach actually is to argue, but it really has this, it has the legal intonation again. It can mean to argue or to dispute, and it can definitely be considered a legal term in ancient Hebrew because it can also mean to bring evidence.
And to tease out to a conclusion, right?
Right. And so basically what he's saying is, I desire, you guys could passively accept this, that this is just the justice of God. But I want to speak to God, and I want to be able to bring my evidence from my case here. And then and he says, however, you spread your lies, you quacks. he basically tells them, you guys are quacks. If this is the type of comfort you want to bring to someone who's suffering, you're all a bunch of quacks.
Mm.
You're worthless physicians. Who needs friends like you?
And we've and haven't we all experienced that when we've gone, you know what, I'm going to go and get a second opinion. You know, you might have gone to a doctor and he's gone, listen, look at your symptoms. Obviously, you've got XYZ. Just go and, you know, get this prescription. And that's what they're doing. They're looking at the symptoms, not the cause. They're looking at the symptoms and they go, oh, I know why. Look, you've got this. Obviously, you've done something wrong. But they're not investigating. They're not listening to Job and going, okay, so you claim to be innocent. You claim to be righteous. You claim to be blameless. How are we to understand that? What conclusions can we come to from they're not doing that? And he's saying, you're misdiagnosing me.
Yep. And then we see this idea of, you know, him saying that if their silence would be their true wisdom, you know, in verse 5, if you would just be silent, that would really be your wisdom. And then in verse 6, he says, hear now my rebuke or my admonition, tochachti. You know, this is the same thing the rebuke that we see in last week's Torah portion in Deuteronomy 28 and 29 in Hebrews called the tochacha, the admonition, you know, where God is admonishing Israel saying that, look, I know you're going to go astray and this is what's going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. And so this is that same word, tochachti. He says, you know, listen to the pleadings of my lips. It says, v'rivot shoftai hakshivu. And we see this in Job chapter 9, verse 3, where he says, im yachpots lariv imo lo ya'anenu achat mini alef. Where he says, if he should want to contend with him, he will not answer him one in a thousand. You know, basically what he's saying is, if I wanted to bring, my lips, my contention with him, he wouldn't listen. And actually that word yachpots that we see is from chafetz, which means to desire. We see that in one of my favorite verses in scripture in Psalm 34, when it says, mi ha'ish ha'chafetz chayim, who is the man that desires life? So he's saying, so even if I delighted in bringing a court case against God, he would not listen, but one in a thousand cases.
Sure.
And then, we also see again, the same word in Job chapter 10, verse 2, which we looked at a while back, where it says, Omar Eloha al tarshieni, hodieni al ma tirveni. Okay. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you quarrel with me. Mm-hmm. And we see that word, which is a resh yud bet, to strive or to contend, which really, again, it has a legal connotation, to decide or try a legal case. So now, based on what we know of the Hebrew and the legal terms used, he's basically saying, I will say to Eloha, I will say to God, do not declare me guilty. Let me know upon what are you deciding my case.
Mm.
In other words, how can you declare me guilty without first letting me know what the charge is? That's really where we've come to with these legal words that you have to see in ancient Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. Will you speak wickedly for God, he says to them, and talk deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality for him? Will you contend for God? Will it be well when he searches you out? Or can you mock him as one mocks a man? He will surely rebuke you. If you secretly show partiality, will not his excellence make you afraid and the dread of him fall upon you? Your platitudes are proverbs of ashes. This is great. Your platitudes are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay.
Mm. So I got to go back a little bit because there's really interesting word play that goes on here. Back at, I think it's in verse 8, where it says, Hafanav tisha'un im le'el tirvun, because it says, before his face will you lift up, if for God do you strive or contend. And we know that this idea of lifting the face is something that we see. We talk about this in Numbers chapter 6, verse 26, when it says, and we know that the idea of lifting one's face to another is showing favor.
Mm-hmm.
As we see, Yehovah panav alecha v'yasem lecha shalom, you know. And so Job, so we saw that Job describes his friends as at ease. And he says they only speak based on the determination that he has sinned. So they weave their own theological fantasies, and he basically is telling them that they're bringing small thoughts brought by small men, producing the image of a small God that needs them to contend for him. Mm. And then we read in verse 9 and verse 10, as you did, and we see that again, he will surely rebuke you if in secret you lift your face to him. We see that again. In verse 11, will not his majesty terrify and his dread fall upon you? And the noun in verse 11 is from the same root as the verb nasa, to lift up. We see this again. It says, halo, halo se'eto, tiva'et etchem ufachdo yipol aleichem. And it's basically kind of this play on the previous verses related to lifting one's face to another. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, if you do this secretly, thinking that you are showing favor to God, what will happen when he returns the favor and he examines you and lifts his face towards you? Mm. It's very powerful when you see those kind of word plays that go on in the Hebrew there.
And I like the way that he kind of says to them, listen, you're trying to defend God? You're trying to, you think that it's your job?
I mean, you know, he's like basically accusing them as, you're going to lift your face to God?
Hmm. Will you show partiality for him? Will you contend for him? Yeah, yeah. But I tell you what, it makes me think. There's a lot going on today, Ira. You know, one particular religion that feels like they need to defend their God, that they need to rush out and violently even defend their God and their prophet and so on and so forth. And it makes me think, it makes me wonder how much we do that, that we feel that God needs defending, that he can't defend himself. And it reminds me of the story in Gideon, where they changed Gideon's name because he knocked down the Asherah poles and the Baals, and he destroyed them. And they went to his father's house and said, bring him out, and because we have to defend our God. We have to do this guy in. He's guilty of destroying the Baals, and we have to defend the Baal, and we, you know, bring your son out. And his father said to him, I'm just trying to find it, Yerubbaal, that's right. That was what they changed his name to. And his father said, no, you can't have my son. You know, if Yerubbaal, if Baal is upset, let him defend himself. Let him speak for himself. Let him bring about the justice, is basically what he said.
This is a very touchy subject for me because, you know, earlier today I was just looking at some of the things that are going on. You know, for instance, you know, we see this kind of thing of these people that you're talking about that think that they need to lift their faces toward their God, who, by the way, is a false God, mm-hmm. and not the same God that we serve. But at the same time, they think nothing of mocking the people of God, the chosen people of God. Mm-hmm. There was a situation recently where graves were desecrated on one of God's holy mountains in God's holy land, mm-hmm. and sacred books were burned as well. But we don't see the world rising up, and we don't see the world rising up and trying to calm anybody down, because nobody really feels the need to lift their face for God. Mm-hmm. We are very confident in the fact that Yehovah is more than capable of lifting his face towards us and mm-hmm. lifting his face towards his enemies as well.
Mm. So should that be the attitude that we should take? I mean, I'm talking about Judges chapter 6, verse 32. Therefore, on that day, he called him Yerubbaal, saying, let Baal plead against him because he has torn down his altar. Okay, so he's torn down Baal's altar. Let Baal sort it out. If Baal is powerful, he's a powerful god, does he need men to defend him, or can he not do it himself? And in this particular case, we're seeing in the news, of course, we're talking about Islam, that a lot of angry ants are coming out of the nest and defending their God as if he can't defend himself. And is this not what Elijah said? I know I'm getting off the topic, but I'm on a roll now.
No, I was just going to say that this is the same thing that we saw with Eliyahu.
Mount Carmel. Yeah. Sure. On Mount Carmel, saying, you know, if he is God, let him speak for himself. Let him make it clear. But should it be our position that when Yehovah is insulted by another one of another religion or whatever it may be. Is it up to us to defend him, or is it, how are we to, because here we are in Job, and here are Job's so-called friends that certainly seem to be defending the position of God and doing furthering God's purpose as far as they can tell. Is there a connection here?
So because you went to Judges chapter 6:32, you know, my answer would be that we need to be available. And what happens when God's enemies come if we're available? You brought up Gideon, and if we look two verses later, what do we see? Ruach Yehovah lav sha'a et Gideon. The spirit of Yehovah wore Gideon as a garment. He clothed Gideon. He put Gideon on. And so if we're willing to be available, not lifting our faces for God, but just humbly walking with him, then God can do the same thing that he did with Gideon, and we could be deliverers. We could act as mishichim, as messiahs. I know that's going to be controversial for some people to hear, but Mashiach just means anointed one, and so it wouldn't be unusual for God to anoint anybody in this day to stand up and to be clothed by his spirit and to move on his behalf on the earth.
And if only, as Job pleads, if only his friends would be silent and that they would listen to him, that they would empathize with him, they would listen, they would understand and accept what he was saying, perhaps Yehovah might have put them on. Perhaps Yehovah might have come upon them and spoken to Job. Would have been a much shorter book. But perhaps he would have spoken to Job and explained with Job and reasoned with Job and all of these things might have happened, perhaps, but alas, it's not to be, and they will not hear, and they are persisting in what they believe is furthering God's cause.
Right, and that's why I love that verse 12, where it says, "Zichronechem mishle efer legabe chomer gabechem." What did you read that as verse 12?
Your platitudes, your platitudes are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay.
Right. So the Hebrew, you know, we know as Zichronechem is from Zachor, you know, to remember, but we also know that it means mentions or memorials. So your mentions are proverbs of ash, or actually it could mean are proverbs in the dust. Mm-hmm. And your response is a response of clay. So far argued that there was this deep kind of chasm between man and their understanding of God. That's what he presented in the previous chapters, but before Job begins his response. And so now Job now admonishes his three friends, and basically he's really taunting them. And he's taunting them by saying, if God is so exalted as you claim, which you all have claimed, how can you presume to speak for him with such ridiculous arguments, which the fish, the animals, and everybody else already knows?
Yeah, well, that's it, and yeah, that's right. And he's saying, you know, the things that you sprout that you think is such wisdom is so lofty that only you know are as common as dirt. Come on,
sure.
It's your opinion. It does. Everyone's got an opinion, and you're wrong. It's worth nothing.
Sure.
So you know what? I'm going to take this to verse 19, and we're going to go from verse 20 onto the end of 14 next time, because it kind of turns there. We'll talk about that in a minute. But 13, hold your peace with me and let me speak. Then let come on me what may. Why do I take off? Now, Ira, come on. Verse 14. Why do I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands? What's that?
Well, so this is really like really one of those really weird. It's really one of those weird, you know, so in my translation, what I have, upon what do I carry my flesh and my teeth and my soul I set in the palms of my hands? I'm going to tell you basically what I think this means. Mm-hmm. Basically, what I think he's saying is I will not bite my lip any longer. I will take my chances with what I'm about to say.
And this is
when he now begins to start justifying himself.
Okay, that's interesting. I wouldn't have I can see that. Why do I take my flesh In other words, my lip, perhaps. Yeah. Why do I take
so
my...
So in other words, I've been biting my lip. I've been biting my lip all this time. And
now I'm going to let you guys have it.
Now I'm going to let it go. I've only been taunting you. Now
Never
I'm going to let it go.
Nice guy.
Now I'm going to justify myself, and I'm not biting my lip, and I set my soul in the palms of my hands, and I'll take whatever comes my way.
Now, speaking of difficult verses, 15 is an interesting one to translate, and I'd be interested in, actually, before I even read it, how do you translate 15? What do you understand from 15?
Okay, so 15, what I have is, behold, he may slay me, and I have no hope. Nevertheless, my way is to argue before his face.
Ah, what I have is, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Now, you said, yet I have no hope.
Right.
What I've got is, yet I will trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. Now, the way you read it, we've certainly read verses that carry a similar understanding, that he feels like he has no hope. It's hopeless. And though he may slay me, I have no hope. But this one says, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. Interesting.
Okay. Well, you know, and that's the thing, because, you know, trust, I mean, I don't know how people come to that. I mean, you know, basically verse 15 says, Hein yikteleni lo ayachel, and ayachel there is the word for, you know, this idea of waiting or hoping.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually in, I want to say, I think that's in the PL form from yachal, which basically means to wait or to cause the hope. And so basically he's saying, lo ayachal, you know.
As in no, no.
Lo, no, there is no hope. Okay. You know, even though he slays me and I have no hope, ach derachai el panav ochiach, you know, my even, way, derachai is like derech, you know, the way, you know, nevertheless, my way is to argue before his case. Remember we said hokeach earlier?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we said hokeach to argue or to decide or to dispute. Mm-hmm. Now we have ochiach, which is the same verbal root, which is that idea of arguing before his face or bringing his case and presenting his evidence.
So he's saying, I have no hope. I'm going to the grave, but I'm gonna defend myself all the way there.
That's right. I'm bringing my evidence.
He also shall be my salvation, for a hypocrite could not come before him. Listen carefully to my speech and to my declaration with your own ears. See now, I have prepared my case. Yeah, it's very legal, isn't it? I have prepared my case. Mm-hmm. I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is he who will contend with me? If now I hold my tongue, I perish.
So basically what happens is he's saying to them, I'm willing to take my chances and bring my case and my evidence before him. Mm-hmm. And I know that this will be my salvation, because a hypocrite would never be able to stand in the presence mm-hmm. of God. But I take I take everything into my own hands, knowing that I am blameless. And you, my friends, are the real hypocrites.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's basically saying. He Indeed. Says, you'll hear my speech and my declaration in your ears. Behold, I have prepared my case, because I know myself to be just. Yadati ki ani etzdak. I know myself to be just or to be righteous. Mihu yariv imadi ki ata achrish ve'egva. Who is he that would contend with me? Because now I would be silenced and pass away or expire. It's talking about gasp for breath, as in taking a last breath. He's basically saying, who's going to contend with me? Because, all right, I may take my last breath here. Do not think that the three of you would dissuade me with your arguments from bringing my case. Because if I were to remain silent now, I would surely take my last breath.
Mm. He's a man of integrity, Job. And right here, that's verse 19. And right here in 20, it turns around. And again, as we've seen before when Job is speaking, he then switches from addressing his friends to addressing God.
Yes,
and here in verse 20, he does begin to address God, and I do believe follows through to the end of 14. We have gone for we've taken up our time, my friend. We're going to have to save that till next week.
Sure,
that's all right.
Awesome.
there it is. So once again, I just wanted to remind everyone, Treasures from the Tanakh is, of course, Torah teacher Ira Michelson, a Facebook page now available for people to interact on. If you get onto Facebook and type in Treasures from the Tanakh, you'll probably find a link. You will find a link from the Truth to You Facebook page. And if you haven't liked that, you better do that as well. So,
amen.
There it is. Ira Michelson, my friend, thank you for coming back on to Truth to You.
Thank you, Jono. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate your time, my friend. And until next week, dear listeners, where we're going to kick off from Job 13:20, hopefully getting to the end of chapter 14. Be blessed. Be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.